518-828-0290 or email info@wgxc.org.
Good morning. This is At Issue on WGXC. I'm Victor Mandolia, and I'm with my co-host, Deborah Gilbert. Good morning.
Good morning.
And this morning, we are going to do a little something different. Sometimes sometimes we are the hosts of At Issue, and sometimes we make the news as well. So today we're going to talk with Deborah a little bit about her recent resignation from the town board in the town of Taconic. But before we do that, we are with Council President Don Moore from the City of Hudson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome, Don.
Thank you. Good to be with you both.
So we're going to jump right into it because we're going to have a lot to cover. Week and a half ago. There was a group of law students from the School of Law at Hofstra University who had studied the City of Hudson's government and structure and contracts and things like that, and made quite a number of recommendations to the city. And I wanted to just sort of hear your take on it, and we could go over it. One, there were really four sections of the recommendations.
Right.
The first on contracts and the government structure. The second on the ethics code. The third on conservation and the environment. And the fourth on the weighted vote. The weighted vote certainly has gotten the most attention so far.
Right.
So maybe you could summarize what the recommendations were, and then sort of go from there.
Well, we're all waiting for the students, eight students in Eric Lane's class at the law school at Hofstra University to arrive, and that should be here probably within the next couple of weeks. But they provided a very good executive summary that is an armature for draws out the most important points of their report. There were four teams of two students apiece, and on the first subject there, I'm going to try to run through these fairly quickly, and
sure,
I hope I won't go too fast through them. But the first one was contracts and government structure. First, they recommended that we more clearly delineate the intended role of the mayor and the common council in the contracting process. Now, this is a conversation that with them has been going on for probably about 3 months now, and it's also been going on with myself and with the corporation council and with the mayor, and with the aid of the corporation council, we have now come up with a clearer definition of the roles and responsibilities, specifically that the common council should approve all contracts that are proposed for the city. The mayor, of course, executes them, but the council must approve them all. I had thought that was probably what we should be doing, but it was unclear in the past. It's no longer unclear. Any contract,
which means that the council has tremendous authority as in the granting or the approval of contracts. The mayor is really the signer of those contracts and executes them in a legal sense.
Did they figure this out by looking at state law or by looking at
charter? Looking at the charter.
Okay.
We have approved all the major contracts, and by definition, when the council at the end of each year approves a budget for the coming year, any contracts and or expenditures for those contracts that are assumed within the budget of the coming year are approved by the council, and that will still be the case. But we have now a clear sense of any contracts that come up before the council in the year, in a particular budget year, that were not part of the budget process, were not approved by the council, are now to come before the council, and we have now made a hard and fast rule about that, and I think that's the clear distinction with the council's responsibility. I think that's something that will be very salutary it's good for the city. The second point they suggested was to authorize the treasurer to supervise city contracts to assure adequate funding. I think the supervised contracts here is about making sure that the money is there, and I think that that's probably a role that we probably a statement that we can make even without changing the charter. I think that's probably an appropriate addition to the treasurer's responsibility, and particularly when we have as professional a treasurer as we have right now. Eliminate the this is probably one of the most important issues. Eliminate the commissioner's structure to reduce the overall size of government. I don't think that reducing eliminating commissioners would really reduce the overall size of government, because frankly they don't get paid, and the degree to which they are involved in the daily operations of the city varies a good deal. They also want to. They also are, the students also argue that they that eliminating the commissioners would make city departments directly accountable to the mayor. That I think is very important. I agree with that entirely. And you know, and I said this in the meeting, without any prejudice to those commissioners who are active, and some are on a daily basis, I do think that having the mayor directly responsible makes for clearer authority in a full-time government, and also makes for clearer responsibility to the public.
Don,
however, I would make one modification of that, and that is that I believe that the commissioner of the fire department should retain a commissioner. The reason I say that is that the fire department is entirely volunteer. Second of all, there is no real training outside of the fire department for their work, and indeed we don't hire firemen or fire leadership from outside of the city. It's all homegrown, which is quite a delightful fact. And I think that having a structure that retains a commissioner provides for a sort of upward mobility through training into that position. I'm sorry, Deborah.
I just wondered, are these students in a class that deals with municipalities?
Yes.
And are they under the is there a professor supervising the recommendations they're making? It seems like a wonderful thing to get high-quality legal assistance, I'm assuming for free. But I'm just wondering, how reliable are they?
Well, I think they're particularly reliable. First, there were two faculty members, an attorney, and faculty member named Shira Ostrow, and then, of course, the dean of the school, Eric Lane, who was the lead staff attorney for a major charter revision that happened in New York City during the Koch administration. Dean Lane has established a public law and public administration a curriculum within his school, and indeed from everything that I learned from both Dean Lane and from Cheryl Roberts, who gets a great deal of credit for this since they are colleagues, and she when the city was talking about charter reform, and still is, of course, interested indeed the school in focusing on Hudson. These students were the pick of the litter. This was a competitive class to get into. The faculty had more students interested than they could take, and of course they were all seniors at this. At this moment, seven of the eight of these students have now graduated. So I think it's a very serious effort. There's no effort like this that doesn't need to be independently evaluated again particularly by the city. But they did very serious and very dependable work, and the two faculty members were intimately involved in guiding them and commenting on it from their own experience.
So I want to try to move quickly through the next two things because we don't have a tremendous amount of time, and I really want to be able to talk about the weighted vote.
Right.
So the second segment of their recommendations was on the ethics code, and they say we suggest that the city consider incorporating its ethics code into the charter and amending the code to include A, additional substantive standards of ethical conduct, including an express prohibition against misappropriating city property and funds, and including more detailed provisions relating to conflicts of interest and recusal. B, penalties for ethical violations. C, the establishment of a board of ethics. And D, mandatory ethics training for city officials and employees. Is that something that you support?
My answer is yes.
Right. Because right now that we have a very generic ethics policy, and all of our complaints would be handled by the county board of ethics, right?
Yeah. And right. We need a new ethics code. The ethics code that we have is only partially within the charter. The rest, then you must default to state codes. We need something that is clear, mm-hmm. complete, and our own. I have not seen haven't read the codes that they have suggested, but I've seen other codes from jurisdictions that are, I think, similar to what they're talking about. And yes, I think that's what we should do. Mm-hmm.
We're going to be talking a lot more about ethics and ethics, the ethics board, with Deborah at the end of the show. So the third section was on conservation, and they say we suggest that the city consider amending the charter to A, formalize the city's commitment to the conservation of the Hudson River and its surrounding ecosystem, and B, establish a conservation advisory council, which I believe you did last night, right?
The council unanimously approved a creation of a conservation advisory council, which I have to say the council and the common council president appoint. Which is a first. This advisory council would be made up of experts who would advise city bodies, the council, the planning and zoning commissions, on issues as requested by those bodies. I think it's something that we've long sought, and I also have to say that I have to credit Alderman Dave Marston for his particular leadership in this. We would not have this had he not been advocating for it and encouraging us to pass it. So we have there will be a public hearing on this on June 3rd, and then it goes to the mayor for his signature.
Do you expect that he'll sign it?
I expect that he'll sign it. I have no indication that he won't sign it. Let me put it that way.
Okay.
Don, are all the aldermen pretty much behind this effort?
They're, as I say, they voted unanimously for it last night.
Oh, great. That's great.
Yep.
And just on a side note, I mean, there were a number of votes that were unanimous last night. So do you see a coming together of the council that maybe hadn't been there previously? Is that something that you're noticing?
I don't want to generalize about it, but I certainly can see the point. There were a number of resolutions and laws last night that were considered that at one point were thought to be controversial, and indeed they were. All of the actions went through unanimously last night, and I certainly am hopeful that that means mm-hmm. something. I do think that the new council this is the first session of the two-year term has shown a real willingness to talk more amongst each mm-hmm. other, and address things calmly, and without seeming as much. Territorialism, right. as might have been the case.
And in fact, the Conservation Advisory Council failed in the previous council, right?
No, it did not.
Oh, it didn't. Okay.
No, it's never been brought up.
Oh,
before.
I see. Okay, yeah. I'm mistaken then. Yeah. So there's a number of recommendations under the weighted vote, and certainly the weighted vote has gotten the most attention in the press so far. But so we're going to read through them, and then I'd like to sort of hear your thoughts on them. On the weighted vote, we suggest that the city reconsider its apportionment plan in light of the following. A, the constitutional principle of one person, one vote requires that within any legislative body, each citizen have an equally weighted vote. B, the most common and preferred method of complying with one person, one vote is to draw districts with equal populations. C, weighted voting has been used in counties and only counties as a means of complying with one person, one vote, while simultaneously preserving representation for traditional independent political subdivisions provisions such as towns and cities. D, the justification for permitting weighted voting at the county level does not apply with as much force to a single political jurisdiction such as a city. And E, even if weighted voting within a city satisfies the constitutional requirement of one person, one vote, the method that Hudson uses to weight the vote, which relies upon a mathematical calculation that allocates votes based upon the relative voting power of each district rather than in proportion of the population of each district, raises constitutional questions. So maybe you could just briefly explain the method that we use now, and then we'll talk further.
Since I believe 1973 or 74, when the city first adopted weighted voting, when the city more directly first acknowledged that it needed to live by the one person, one vote requirement of the Supreme Court, the city's apportionment of voting within its legislative body, the Common Council, has been done on the basis of a weighted vote. The weighted vote, which is so that everyone understands, there are 10 aldermen and a Common Council president. We do not vote with one vote. Alderman is elected from a ward where the lines have been drawn for maybe 80 years and do not change. They represent different-sized populations, and those different-sized populations are translated into, in effect, a different numerical vote within the council, so that the first ward alderman and the fourth ward alderman have approximately, I think, 95 votes apiece, and the fifth ward aldermen have approximately, I think, 367 votes apiece. The basis
in effect, the fifth ward aldermen have more than three times the voting power on the council as the lowest members, the first and the fourth wards.
Right, correct. Now the Supreme Court has approved weighted voting apportionment plans, and so they're in common use in many places around the country. However, the students from Hofstra, I think, had two principal concerns. One is that the Banzhaf formula, which is an algorithm that is used to make these high-level computer calculations of apportioning weighted votes, is open to substantial question. And the second is that there is no city in the state of New York, and they think no city in the country, that uses a weighted vote apportionment system. And so then the question is, if indeed they are correct, and indeed that needs to be, you know, that we need to see their report and see the legislative basis and the factual arguments that undergird their reservations, if not objections to the Banzhaf formula. If indeed they are correct, where do we go from there? I think it's relatively easy to say at a dispassionate level that equal voting districts is the fairest way to proceed. In other words, the city would have five or six voting districts that would be adjusted every 10 years with the decennial census, to be sure that that each district had the same number of voters, the same population, not the same number of voters, but the same population, and hence each member of the council would have a single vote.
And there can be slight fluctuations in that. I think it's up to 5% or 10%.
The Supreme Court has allowed that there be a 10%, up to 10% variation in the population.
And that's practical, right?
Well, it's the law.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say that that it's just too confusing and it's too much. But of course, municipalities, all the other municipalities in the country do this redistricting every 10 years. So right. It may be a pain, it is not unlike what every other municipality has to do. So it would seem like it's relatively simple and correct to do.
Right. I mean, there are one or two interesting considerations that I'd add to that, which is that, you know, when the Supreme Court first agreed to deal with one person, one vote, when they first agreed to interfere within states about voting issues, they did so largely because of issues of race, because in a number of cases that they found that racial minorities were being systematically gerrymandered out to a point where they had no power, and that was the basis for the constitutional movement for the Supreme Court to interfere in an area that had been exclusively considered mm-hmm. a state domain voting. And that would be something that we would want to be sensitive to here as well,
right?
Which is the question of, you know, we have large minority populations, and we do not want to. We want to make sure that they are not placed at any disadvantage. So there are other fine points, and of course, there is the question of tradition, which is raised, and the tradition here is that. That the ward boundaries have been in existence for so long that they somehow represent some cultural importance, and indeed, you know, we can see that they do represent some cultural importance. Mm-hmm. But the question is whether or not if indeed this Banzhaf formula, which has been the basis for the weighted vote apportionments for the last 50 years. Or more, 50 years. If that is somehow questionable within the context of a city like ours, then indeed there is something to look at to be sure that the fundamental issue of one person, one vote is primary in our consideration.
So the case could theoretically be made that the first ward, which has a high gay population or has a large minority population as well with the Hudson Terrace, and the second ward, which has a high black population, the fourth ward also has a large black population. The case could be made that those wards are being discriminated against by having such a lower weighted vote than the predominantly white district of the fifth ward.
I'm not a constitutional scholar, and I am not, and I would well, I think that no, I'm serious.
No,
I
and certainly I don't careful. Expect. To, I mean, I'm putting it out there. I'm not really expecting
right.
you to respond to
no.
To
no,
it.
I think that we need to be careful about that because indeed, insofar as they are represented, I don't know how